Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog, and you can find us online at speculist.com, or you can go straight to blog.speculist.com if you want to skip a step and get straight to the good stuff. On Fast Forward Radio and on the Speculist, we talk about emerging technologies, emerging possibilities. We talk about a future that's coming that we think is going to be very much worth living to see. And with me, as always, I have my co-futurist and co-blogger, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
Well, I'm great, and you must be riding high off the BCS National Championship game last week.
I am. My state's team, LSU, won, and it was a big deal. We did not think that they were even going to be in the game a couple times during the season, and then everything just worked out well for them, and they became the first team to ever win that championship with two losses. So
is that right?
Okay. That's right. So, very first time. It's always been a one-loss team in the past, but it just everything kind of fell into place for them mathematically. I don't claim to have any understanding of how that all works, but it all fell into place for them, and they managed to get to the game and then win it. And it was an exciting game too. It wasn't, you know, how sometimes the Super Bowl or various championship games can kind of be dull.
Somebody just runs away with it, and then it's all over.
Well, this one wasn't like that. Not for me. It seemed to me that Ohio was in the game all the way to the end, although they were behind from basically the second quarter on, but they never gave up, and they played hard, and it was a fun game to watch.
Well, that must make it exciting when they're behind most of the game, and you know you're kind of on the edge of your seat, but then they pull it off.
I had a sinking feeling during the first quarter. I mean, it was 10-0 Ohio, and it seemed like LSU had a case of the jitters, which is understandable, you know.
Well, sure.
But they got themselves together.
Although it's hardly their first time playing on the national stage. I mean, they've been around before, right?
Well, you know, those particular players, probably it is.
Oh, well, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, for the franchise, but it's always a different team.
Yeah, that's right. Every year it's a new set of guys. Sometimes, maybe they play 2 or 3 years, but at the most. But this is the first time for those guys. And so, yeah, you can imagine that they were a little jittery.
So what was the final score?
I think it was like 38 to 20 something. I did not.
You knew that LSU won. I mean,
yeah, it was
your takeaway.
Clear win.
Team won. So
yeah. So, okay. But it was a great game. If you missed it, it was a good game.
Well, I didn't actually get a chance to watch all of it. I think I had it on for a few minutes, but I was doing other things. But I did. Of course, it was all the talk that they had won, and we've been tracking LSU's progress here on Fast Forward Radio since baseball season, really, since we started the show on Blog Talk Radio. I think we've been,
and you know, we kind of laughed at the time because we just just happened to bring it up because this is a show about the future. You know, we're a couple of futurists. You know, people don't listen to this show for sports talk necessarily, but
and here we are doing our first 3 or 4 minutes talking.
Yeah, well, and it just became kind of an ongoing segment. You know,
right.
We find it interesting. Therefore, sorry guys, y'all get to hear about it.
That's right, you get to hear about it. But now, I guess having established LSU is the national championship, football season is over. I guess we can Super Bowl coming up a couple weeks, but we haven't really tracked the NFL since the Broncos have been out of it, and that's been quite a while.
College ball is I'm always so much more in tune with college ball than the pros.
Well, there you go. So really,
no, probably no more sports until next football season.
I was going to say we can retire the sports feature until spring training starts.
In a month.
we can pick it back up then. In the meantime, maybe we'll find some other interesting topics to talk about. And in fact, that is one of the one of the things we need to get out there about this evening is that we don't have a guest tonight, and maybe you'd like to say a word about that.
Well, you know, the thing is, we have had some outstanding guests. This is like almost our 30th show. It's like in the upper 20s we've done, and we have had a bunch of guests over the 2 or 3 years we've been doing this, Phil, and we've never had a dud, as far as I'm concerned. I've never had a guest that I went, you know, I really wish we hadn't had that person on the show. They didn't contribute. I didn't learn anything from them. We've not had a single person like that.
No, they've all been fascinating. It's been an honor to talk to just about everybody we've had on the show, and it's been terrific talking with some of these folks. And I have to say, keeping true to what I said, I think it was 2 weeks ago tonight, that PJ has to be up there in the top couple or three all-time guests, right, in case she's listening.
That's right. And, you know, and Tobias as well. From last week, we've made some good friends. We've learned a lot from every one of these guests. You know, I think, though, that tonight we're going to have something unusual in a sense, because without a guest, you know, we're going to have to hit the news hard. And we've got so much to talk about. Tonight, the news is the guest.
Right, right. So, we'll let the future be our guest.
That's right.
On Fast Forward Radio, which is only appropriate. And it gives us a chance to catch up on some of that, because we've not spent a lot of time talking about big developments or the kinds of stories that catch our attention over the last few weeks when we've done the more guest-oriented shows. So I think it's probably good that we do this every now and then, have a show that's just... just the two of us talking about the big stuff going on. So where shall we start?
Well, you want to start with the biggest thing or work our way up to that?
Work our way up to that? Let's work our way up to that. Let's start with that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the no sleep pill then. You were kind of following that.
Well, yeah, that was a really interesting one. That's been about a week ago that I put that up. And it's actually, I think it's more in the nature of a nasal hormone, I think, is the way it works, but it's research that DARPA has done, and they've come up with this drug that eliminates sleepiness via a nasal spray that kicks off it triggers this hormone in the brain that then tells your body you don't need sleep after all, and they say that the spray has worked actually quite well in lab experiments with no apparent side effects. And they have this hope that it's going to be a sleep replacement. So, you know, DARPA, obviously, they would have an interest in soldiers out in the field or pilots or anybody who, you know, on the defense side of things is pulling a long shift. We can condition for a lot of things, but it's really hard to take away that need after, you know, 36 hours or so sometimes these guys pull. Eventually, you got to fall asleep. I mean, you can pump people up with different kinds of stimulants. You can have them drinking coffee. You can, you know, you can give them speed. You can, there's all kinds of things you can do. But eventually, the need to sleep kicks in. But with this drug, apparently, what happens is it just throws the switch, and suddenly, boom, the need to sleep is gone.
And it's just as if you were rested and ready to go. And pretty much any job. It's not just soldiers. I can imagine just about any job that sleep, you know, being sleepy is a dangerous thing. You would benefit, you know, if you're a long haul trucker.
Absolutely, a truck driver, bus driver, anybody.
Surgeon
with that. Well, and you think about medical students and these residents, right? Doctors who are first starting out, they put them on these shifts where they run, you know, 2 or 3 days at a time, right? The whole fighting against needing to sleep is a huge thing that they encounter all the time. So yeah, it seems like there would be major applications of this sort of thing if it pans out for people in a lot of different fields. And also, just, you know, you think about college students.
Yeah,
right? The big test is tomorrow. I have to stay awake. I've still got you know, half a textbook of geology I need to read in order to take the test tomorrow morning. So,
you know, I tried to pull a couple of all-nighters, in my freshman year in college. I found it was counterproductive, and I quickly, you know, learned better time management skills, so I didn't have to. I suppose if you had a drug like that, then, you know, it could help you in a crunch.
That is very commendable, Stephen, I have to say, because I pulled all-nighters throughout my entire college career. And
well, maybe I was just lazy, Phil, and you were the one that was doing right. But
you just decided they were counterproductive, right? I won't learn anything. I'm going to bed.
yeah, I'm going to bed. I don't care.
Okay.
But you haven't studied, Steve. Well, I don't care. I'm going to bed.
So I'm looking at this as if the thing pans out, it might help people like myself who have a major coffee addiction going on. Because what this does is it gives you a completely clear and awake frame of mind so that you're able to tackle whatever whatever task you're facing. But beyond that, we start looking at kind of more speculative sort of questions about this. You say, well, what if this thing pans out and this hormone really is the key? Your body doesn't actually, it turns out, require sleep, right?
Right.
It's just something that, and there are actually evolutionary, there are various evolutionary theories as to why we sleep. And I don't know what the definitive answer is, but one that I heard about that I found was just absolutely fascinating was that it protected us from predators.
How so? I mean, because predators can eat you while you sleep.
Well, they can eat you while you sleep, but they have to find you. So it was like this method of becoming inactive while it was dark outside so that you'd be a lot harder for the predators to
spot. I don't buy that. I'm sorry, Phil. That doesn't strike me as right because, the predators sleep too, even at those at the top of the food chain.
Yeah, well, but of course it didn't evolve as a human characteristic. It evolved much lower down evolutionarily speaking, for less evolved prey and less evolved predators, but that's where sleep originally came from. Anyway, there's there's a number of different theories as to why we sleep, but all of them lead to you get into the counterfactual. You know, we talk about stuff like, in fact, we'll be talking about in just a little while, stuff that goes against the grain, like combating aging. What about combating sleep? What if you could live your life without having to take 8, 9, 7, whatever hours out of your life every day?
Like maybe sleep, a few hours on the weekend and then spend the rest of the week awake.
Exactly.
Something like that. It certainly could be productive, but, we got into a discussion in the comments. When you posted that, there was a couple of people that came in and said, I kind of like sleep. I like at the end of the day, chilling out, hanging with your loved ones, going to bed. That's the whole process is a human social thing, and I'd hate to have to do without that. I can understand that point. That's right.
Oh, sure.
And we live our life with a certain rhythm, and part of that rhythm is at the end of the day we check out for about 8 hours. I can see that. It would be something I would want to use just occasionally, even if there were no side effects at all, and I would probably just stick with my normal habits, and just use it on occasion when I thought when I had a project or something that needed to be done. But
see, I would counter that what we've done here is we've made a virtue out of a necessity, right?
Yeah,
we've in the same way that we build a lot of ritual around the daily meal,
right?
Because ultimately we have to eat or we starve to death, right? I mean, is the ultimate thing. It's like, well, there's no choice but that we have to go to sleep. Therefore, we've got social constructs that go around them. But if we didn't sleep, if we never had to sleep, we'd have different social constructs, and our lives would still be pretty cool, I think. But you're right, we would lose something in the process.
Well, let me bring up another point. What if, let's just say that, we're of two totally different mindsets about this. The drug comes along, there's no side effects at all. You decide you're going to use it all the time, and you go about your life, using it. And I use it on occasion when I've got a major project or something.
Right.
And, but much of the rest of the world starts using it more and more. Who's going to get left behind?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Me.
That's the.
And so, sometimes one person doesn't decide how the world works. That sort of thing is rather democratic.
Use all that time to do? Let's face it, Stephen. I mean, I want to be very frank and honest with you here. I'd be blogging, okay?
Okay.
So I'd be getting like 5 or 6 good posts in every night while you were snoozing, okay, pal?
I wake up, I have all this interesting stuff to read, but I have not contributed at all to the blog.
That's right. I mean, I would just own that blog at that point, okay? You'd have no chance to catch up.
That's right.
But I can't think of how else, though, you would really... I mean,
you might have another job, or your job actually, instead of being an 8-hour day job, might turn into a 12 or 13-hour day job, and then you have another 12 hours to spend with your family or whatever, you know.
Well, that is the insidious part of it is that employers might just start to expect that
you put 13 hours in a day.
You know, you
everybody
know,
does it, you know.
Yeah. Come on, you're on salary here. You're not being paid hourly. You've got more work to do, right?
Yeah.
And they could really load it on. So there's all kinds of I don't know, more positive and less positive possibilities for that. Though I think it's kind of hard to get your head around, though. I mean, it's hard to imagine really living that way, to think, you know, because. I mean, I can't even frame a day, right? Because to frame a day, you say, well, you get up every morning and blah. But here, you wouldn't get up every morning. You know, you're already awake. You would.
Well, you know, technology has a way of re-engineering our lives, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I graduated from college, just a few short years ago, I had never been on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
The only cell phone I ever saw was like in Wall Street, you know, where what's his name's walking on the beach, you know.
Right. Yeah. Michael Douglas. Yeah.
Yeah. With the lunchbox sized, you know, cell phone. Nobody had cell phones, and you know, that's so it's you know, everybody has them now, and we're all on the internet, and our lives are much different because of it. That drug became available. It's just like another piece of technology. So it's hard to know how our lives would be different. So
we shall see.
That's right.
So where do we go next? What's our next hot news story we want to touch on?
Well, I guess we could go into an energy topic.
Okay.
You know, we recently had Zubrin on the show, and he has warned us that pretty much, you know, we should not expect gas prices to go down.
Right.
And I'm kind of a mind that he's probably right. Well, now we see a vehicle coming out called the Nano. It's not, you know, it's going to be sold in India and going to be sold in, you know, China probably, but India first.
Right.
And in other developing countries around the world. If you haven't seen a picture of it, you can come to our show notes and we'll have it there. But let me just kind of describe it. It looks a little bit like a Volkswagen Bug.
Uh-huh. Kind of a squared off Bug.
Yeah.
Sort of.
We'll sit four adults, but you can't be a huge adult, you know, no big, huge people, but it's
right.
It would sit four adults, you know, semi-comfortably, and if you're in the developing world, there would probably be four adults with room to spare.
Right, exactly.
But it's four adults, and the car costs, here's the kicker, the car costs $2,500 U.S.
Wow.
And so you're talking about a car, bringing a car to people that would allow people to buy their first car ever, and lots of people to have their first car ever. And, you know, you can't blame.
You know, just by way of comparison, what would the next cheapest car be? I mean, I don't even really know. What is the entry level?
I have no idea. Hey, you know, and I'm sure it's not a car that's sold in this, you know, in this country.
Right.
Look, cars in this country are naturally going to be more expensive, not only because, you know, people kind of have an expectation of paying minimum, you know, what, $15,000?
Right.
But also because we have so many safety, you know, stuff that's added on into cars. We've got the safety glass. We've got, you know, collapsible steering columns. We've got airbags, you know, anti-lock brakes. All of these things are, like, mandated. And they're expensive things. You know
they're expensive in more ways than one. One of the things, I think it was in Zubrin's book, I'm not completely sure, but somewhere I read recently that, do you remember back in the 70s when we first got concerned about foreign oil and there was this first push for meeting higher
fuel efficiency, yeah.
Yeah, fuel efficiency standards.
Yeah, yeah.
And Detroit was coming out with cars that got really pretty darn good gas mileage.
Right.
And in fact, a lot of the cars you see today don't get nearly as good a gas mileage as those cars did. And
well, because we're driving tanks now.
Clearly the tanks are going to be different, but the vehicle that they pointed out was like the Honda, what is it, CRX? CRV, what's it called? That little Honda sports car. Whatever it's called.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
CR something.
Okay.
I think it's a CRX. Because the new version of that that came out in 2008 actually gets less good gas mileage. Its gas mileage is actually quite a bit less impressive than the one that they first came out with back in the 80s. And the reason is because all these safety features, you know, and this is apples to apples, same vehicle, right?
Right, right.
We're not talking about because you're driving a tank. We're talking about because you're driving a car built in the regulatory environment we have now, and the cars just have to be heavier. They have to have a lot more stuff in them, and they just can't.
In order to be crash-worthy, they have to be bigger. They have to have more mass.
They have to be bigger and heavier. That's exactly right.
Okay, okay. Well, yeah, and so that's another way that those things cost us money. Now, I mean, you know, if you're in a crash, you're going to be glad to have all those things, crumple zones, collapsible steering columns and all that.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, if you're in the developing world, you don't pay for that stuff. You know, it's like 1940. And, you know, the cars we had in 1940, that level of safety, that's perfectly acceptable in India and China and other developing countries. That, you know, and as they develop, they're going to demand more safety, just like we did, but they're not there yet. And so they're more concerned about getting in their first car.
Right.
Which is understandable. And, you know, and I don't blame any of these people for wanting cars. And there's a lot of good that will come of more people having cars. It will advance the world economy, you know, which is good for the entire world. But there's going to be more people chasing the same amount of petroleum, even if we don't see the peak oil nightmare. There's going to be more people chasing the same amount of oil out there, and therefore it's oil and gas is not going to come down, and in fact it will probably go up.
Now, one thing we can say for the Tata Nano is that it probably gets very good gas mileage.
Probably so, but, you know, you put 1 million of them on the road.
Or 100 million.
Yeah, exactly. And
right.
you start seeing that, yeah, it's going to be, that starts to affect our gas prices and everything. And again, you know, I don't blame them or hold that against them at all. They, you know, I would want my first car, you know. If I was a farmer living in some remote place in India, I would, you know, that'd be a dream come true. So you can't begrudge them that. But
just this past week, went out with my daughter and helped her buy her first car.
You know? All right, that's awesome. What car did you get for her?
It's a Subaru Outback.
Okay.
We're actually Subaru family now.
Okay.
You know,
nice cars.
Get the car sponsorship for his podcast. Maybe we can.
Yeah, we need Subaru for
something out here.
Yeah,
yeah,
we have Volvo or something for him.
Yeah, I think his is Volvo. Yeah,
yeah.
Which I hear are also very good cars.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
I'm just throwing it all out there. I'm sorry, that was a bit of a digression, but I'm just saying. Yeah, it's a major growing up point in our culture. You know, when you get your first car, it's a rite of passage to get your first car.
That's right.
And it's important. You have to have it. I mean, she needs to go into school. She needs to be able to get around. And people in other
ditto countries. For the guy in the remote village in India.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, yeah, it's going to be, you know, more people wanting to get around and be mobile. And so you can't blame them, but at the same time, it's going to affect our gas prices. And so what do we do about that? Well, we've kind of covered this ground, you know. We're going to have to look at biodiesel. We're going to have to look at flex fuel. Going to have to look at better batteries and our capacitors to store electricity to go up and down the road with. And ultimately, I think we need to go to nuclear power for our electricity. So, you know, we as a country need to, I mean, make a Manhattan-style or Apollo project-style program to move in that direction, I think. But anyway.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about this is when you look at it, this demand is not just the demand that we'll be facing.
Right.
As the new Indian drivers, the new Chinese drivers come online, they're going to be facing the same level of demand. So I wonder if India is looking at alternative fuels. I wonder if they're looking at flex fuel vehicles. I know that, as we talked about briefly last week, somebody in India is talking about coming to market with a compressed air car.
Right.
Which,
and in Brazil, they're the original flex fuel guys, basically, right? Brazil has flex, you know, they're doing, burning all kinds of things down there in their engines, aren't they?
Well, absolutely, yeah. They started out with this decision that they would not have to import any oil at all, and they'd just grow all their fuel in the form of sugar cane, which they would then turn into ethanol and burn that. But at some point, I think it was in the 80s, the price of gas dropped so low that it was actually a better deal to burn gas than it was to burn ethanol. And that's when they made the switch to flex fuel.
Right.
It was a very prescient move on their part because they said, you know, they didn't say, oh, we got to switch from ethanol back to gas. They said, wait a minute, if the price is going to vary and the availability of fuels is going to vary, we want to be able to have one or to have the other. And, you know, once you go flex fuel, you get methanol thrown in free.
I guess. Right. Exactly. And you get, you know, that's relatively, it's a cheaper liquid, isn't it? I mean, that, than the ethanol, isn't it?
Methanol is cheaper. Methanol does not, it takes, I want to say this correctly, it takes more methanol to produce the same amount of energy, however.
Okay.
So you burn through methanol faster than ethanol. And, of course, you burn through ethanol faster than you burn through petroleum.
Right.
So that's one factor people have to be aware of it when they're looking at burning these alternative fuels is if you fill your car if you got a flex fuel car and you fill it completely with gas, it's actually you're gonna get the farthest miles on that amount of
per gallon.
Yeah.
But you're gonna spend twice as much a gallon as you would ethanol.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean,
or more. Really.
It balances out, but it comes down to this thing about how, you know, not just how much you're paying and how far you're driving, but also how often you have to fill your tank. These all become.
Yeah, you might spend a few more. You'll end up going by the place more often. But I mean, let's say you had a flex fuel hybrid, you might not be going to the pump so much anyway.
Exactly.
So, especially
a plug-in hybrid.
Right.
You know, if you can get most of your driving done every day off what you've juiced it up with overnight, and take it home. You know, you might be looking at a tank you only have to fill once a month or something.
Yeah, even though the energy the potential energy in the liquid you're putting in your car is less. So
right.
Anyway, it's an interesting future there, and that's but anyway, I do believe that, you know, expensive gas is here to stay. So if there's two potential positives that could come from this. Number one, world economy improves because more people are more mobile, and therefore, you know, the economy, you know, there's more opportunity for more people to contribute to the world economy. I think that's a fine thing. But
yep.
And then the other thing is that we're, you know, forced, even though we would rather not to, maybe to consider other possibilities that ultimately may pay off big. And so, you know, I'm not all pessimistic. I'm not all doom and gloom, even though I think that the cheap car may affect our gas prices. I'm not doom and gloom about it.
It may well affect our gas prices, although I'll give you one scenario where the price of oil may yet go down.
Okay, how?
That would be if the developed world got serious enough about flex fuels, if we really started developing alternative fuels seriously, OPEC might look at that situation and go, we've got to nip this in the bud, and they might drop the price of oil drastically just to drown out the competition.
Well, if the demand decreases, then all of a sudden they got all this supply on their hands, then the price would drop, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. That's the other way it might happen.
Yeah.
So they might do it strategically, or they might end up having it happen just because...
that's what the market says.
Yep.
Yep.
Both possibilities.
Yep. Well, I want us to get to our big news, Phil.
Okay, we're halfway through the show. We've
kind of been hinting around this.
Yeah,
and I can't believe I have not blogged about this week. I have not written about it at all.
Well,
this,
you know what? Until we talked about it before the show, I hadn't even heard about this. So this is a huge sleeper story. Got past both of us. So,
well,
tell me what's going on.
It's a big deal. A company by the name of Certrus. They have been basically they've been looking at the chemical that's in red wine, resveratrol. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've heard for years that red wine's
drink
good.
Red wine.
Drink red wine. A glass a day is pretty good. A bottle a day is probably not so good. But you know, and turns out there is something in red wine that's helpful to you. And come to find out, it's resveratrol is that chemical, and they've tested on various animals, and on all the animal models that I'm aware of that's been tested on, it's a life extension drug.
Now, how does resveratrol extend an animal's life? What does it do exactly?
It mimics the same chemical pathways that calorie restriction provides. You put an animal on a near starvation diet, and for some reason they live longer.
Well, some animals anyway. We know it's been tested. It's been proved over and over with mice for sure.
You cut a mouse
down to about, what is it, about 60% of what it would normally eat calorie wise.
And quickly, if you took it down to like 59%, it shortens their life. You know,
right,
I mean,
yeah.
it's like a razor edge, but you put them right at that point of near starvation,
right,
and it increases their life, and
considerably. You get mice living to the human equivalent of what, 120, 130 years old, something like that.
Yeah, and so, you know, but unfortunately, that's not a lifestyle that any of us find pleasant. And
it would be a very hard thing for humans to do, although some have tried.
Some have tried, and some are doing it.
There are people working on doing it.
And there,
although it's not been established one-to-one that it would work for humans.
Right.
I mean,
so it seems like a lot of trouble to go through for those of us who like their cheeseburgers, and I do. And so, so it seems like a whole lot of trouble for something that has not been proven, and so I'm not going to go there. And Sartre sees this huge opportunity. Okay, what can we do to mimic this, what's going on with calorie restriction? Well, come to find out, this chemical in red wine, resveratrol, does much the same chemically. And so they said, well, let's see if we can tweak it. They come up with a drug they call it SRT-501. And it's like resveratrol that's five times as easy to absorb.
Okay,
so therefore it's more potent. And they tried it in we knew that they were getting started with human trials last fall. We covered that. We blogged about it. But this week it comes out.
Now, we did say the human trials were for treating diabetes. Is that right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Because I mean, human trials. Let's see if this makes people live longer. Well, we'll be back to you in 50 years.
Yeah, right.
You know, you can't do that. So what they do is they we know that as you get older, diabetes becomes a more serious problem.
Right.
So let's get a bunch of diabetics in here and give one a sugar pill and one group a sugar pill and one group this SRT-501 and see what happens. Well. In the group of 20 or so, I think it was like 23, 28, I'm looking at the article here, 28 people, that's not right, excuse me, 20. It was a 28-day study.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but it was a small group of people. In that 28-day study, they took it on a daily basis, and their blood sugars went way down. And so, obviously, it had an effect, and so... They're going to continue with the human trials, and that was a big thing. They wanted to be able to say this drug has an effect, that it's not just this is not just a placebo or something. This has a noticeable effect, and now they've got to prove that hey, this doesn't hurt anybody, and it does good. It doesn't hurt you, and therefore we have a marketable drug. They want to, and they're hopeful if all goes well that they'll have it on the market by 2012.
I was just looking at the article here. It looks like it was 67 patients who were
okay. Thank you. Okay, so 67 patients in a 28-day study.
Okay, had their blood sugar noticeably drop. Now, one of the things that this makes me wonder is, did they know going in? They must have had some reason to think, not just that this is a. I mean, were they testing it as an aging drug, or did they have specific reasons to believe it would drop blood sugar, or were they just saying no because it makes you because it reverses aging, or because it fights aging, this will lower blood sugar. You know what I'm saying?
I find it hard to believe that they went into it completely blind.
Yeah.
They must have had some reason to believe that this would work for diabetics.
Right.
But you know,
you
it's kind of,
you know, why not cancer patients? Why not?
Yeah.
Glaucoma, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things associated with aging, but they went with diabetes. You can see why. I mean, going to market standpoint, there's a substantial market for diabetes drugs. So
absolutely,
that makes sense.
And so you know, here we got this drug that helps people with diabetes. And so you know, we've often thought that you know, when we get our anti-aging drug, then the cure for all these other things that are age related will come along for the ride. Well, it looks like it may go the other way. we get anti-aging along for the ride when we get something that helps us treat diabetes and other age-related illnesses.
Interesting. Yeah, well, it can work either way. That's
yeah.
for sure.
And so, I had said back in 2004, I made this bold prediction.
All right, let's hear it.
Okay, my prediction back in 2004, I wrote on the blog. In 10 years, we will have on the market the first generation of anti-aging drugs. So about 2014, and so if this comes out, I'll be right with 2 years to spare. So I'm kind of proud of that.
Very, very nice work. So if these guys get their market, even if they're 2 years late on their current prediction, you'll still be right.
That's right. Because this is a drug that's thought to increase human life expectancy, and so anyway, I'm very, very happy that this is coming along, and I'm very excited about what this could mean, because first generation, it's not going to be perfect or great. It's not going to reverse the aging process. It just might slow it a little bit and give you a little more time to reach the next generation of aging treatment.
Right.
And so that's
all you need, right?
Just enough to get there.
At some point, you just need enough gas to get you to the gas station
to the
gas. Top of the next hill, right?
That's right. The next milestone. That's
right. The trick. Now, are there speculations? Are there thoughts as to what kind of effect this will have on the aging process for people? Are they saying or is
they probably know, Phil? I just have to believe that somebody in a lab there at Sertris has a good idea, but they can't say it. They got to play this thing straight,
right,
in order to bring something that's bring something to the market. And you can't go off making all what could be perceived to be unbelievable claims.
Sure.
Much better to deliver something to market that's much better than we realize.
Absolutely.
Than to not be able to deliver it at all because, you made some sort of preposterous, what is perceived to be a preposterous claim.
Well, I mean,
about
if they were saying this will add 80 years to the average human lifespan,
everybody go, pfft.
Yeah, we'd all say, well, okay. So
yeah, you guys are out to lunch.
This is snake oil. Although it would be terribly exciting if they were saying 10.
Yeah.
If they were saying that and somehow could back it up. But
well,
I guess they're not going to say that until they can back it up. That's the point.
And here's just me completely, just making a guess, but I believe that somewhere in between 10
okay.
and 80.
Okay.
And the other thing is, Sertris has announced that they're working on a second compound that will have 1,000 times the potency of resveratrol.
And the current one, is 500, so this will be twice.
Five times.
Five times. Okay, so this will be 200 times as potent as what they're currently testing on these folks.
Right. And so.
Wow.
Buy stock in Sertris. I think I will.
So let's see. Even if
you thought
1,000 years of your life, I think,
yeah.
According to my mathematics. So you heard it here first. 1,000 years added to your life.
I don't think it'll work quite like that. But it's
Hey, I multiplied it out, Steve.
Yeah. Okay, math doesn't lie. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. I'll print the formula on the block.
Okay.
Written down. But no, this is a huge step forward, and it really is. Neat to see this happening. I mean, when we started out blogging just a few years ago, the idea that anti-aging treatments would be available in the future, that was something we could predict would happen, and
yeah.
not to see that we're that much closer to that being realized.
This is a great example of what you would call practical time travel, Phil, because, we were living in a reality a couple of years ago when this was such pie in the sky that if I told members of my family, they thought I would checked out. They thought I was crazy. And now I can, put the article on their desk. Here, they've got it. It's, and it's been proven effective in humans.
Right. And you know what they'll say? Oh, I guess you're right.
I don't get any credit for that, but for knowing in advance. But yeah,
because we're hurtling into this future so fast that it's hard to even.
People. It takes more and more to surprise people. Seems like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the, things that they would have regarded as preposterous a couple of years ago are happening, and when they happen, they're not even all that surprising.
Okay,
yeah. Well, there it is, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, okay. We're there.
I suppose they do those things. Whatever. So yeah,
the big they. Yeah. You know, why don't they do? You know. Well,
exactly.
They delivered big this time.
They absolutely did, and we can look for more big stuff from them, hopefully in the very near future.
Yep.
Well, how about something a little less huge? Did you see the piece I put up just today about mind reading via MRI?
Yeah, I did. And that, you know, talk about here's another area that is advanced so fast. A lot of people didn't realize that this was happening. Like what? 6 months ago, they were, you know, if they you know, did a MRI on somebody, they couldn't tell between, you know, if you were thinking about this category of thing or that category of thing. Now they're in subcategories.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And, but give the specific example, Phil.
Well, the one that was mentioned in the article was that 6 months ago, this couldn't reliably say whether you were thinking about faces or places. Okay, so you could be looking at a picture of the Gulf of Mexico, or you could be looking at a picture of Madonna, and it
couldn't tell the difference.
It could not reliably tell the difference between those two things. Today, it can with 78% accuracy, and this is a MRI scan of the brain. They can now look at that and tell within 78% accuracy whether you're looking at and thinking about a hammer or a pair of pliers. So we're down into the weeds of the subcategories at this point.
You know, this is a little bit spooky, Phil.
It really is.
I mean, you know, talk about Big Brother. If some government decided to use this to, you know, interrogate somebody, it could be pretty effective, couldn't it?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, the people who were quoted talking about it, the organizations who are driving this kind of research are law enforcement. This is seen as the true technological way forward for like a real lie detector, one that would really reliably work, and you know a means of finally getting at what's actually going on inside somebody's head, as opposed to
it's not just a lie detector though. What we have now is pretty good. It's hard to beat our present lie detectors, but this is more. This would be the sort of thing that you hook up somebody to, and you get the information you need without them speaking a word.
That's right. It's more like a confession machine, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you just, you know, no need for torture. I guess that's a positive. you hook up the terrorists that you capture, you know, in Afghanistan or wherever, and you hook them up to this machine and say, oh, thanks, and I got what I needed. No need for waterboarding anymore.
Well, yeah, I think we're probably still iterations and generations away from that. Although you make a few more leaps of the same caliber of what we just talked about, going from not being able to hit even on the big broad categories to being able to hit down within the details of categories. You might actually see us moving towards the kind of thing you're talking about. Right now, it's like, you know, hey, this suspect is definitely looking at a pair of pliers right now. I mean,
I don't know how helpful that is.
I think you're still, you know, in this state anyway, that's still not.
Well, you know, you could say to the suspect, how are you going to attack us? And then you could look on the MRI and say, he's thinking about an airplane hitting a building.
Right. Right.
Okay. That would be helpful information. It would have been helpful information on September 10 a few years ago.
Yeah, I think, you know, of course, you got to have the suspect.
Sure.
Yeah, you got to know he's the suspect, and you got to know which question to ask.
Right.
And you've got to have this thing to the point where it's spitting out that kind of open-ended information. I mean, right now they're saying, well, I know it's either a hammer or a pliers. And I
oh,
can
it's
say
either
with
or. It's
yeah.
not. You can't pick it out of the... Of all possible tools.
And when you broaden that to all possible scenarios of crimes or all possible human behaviors, still got quite a ways to go, I would think, before this will have.
Those things tend to surprise us, though.
Well, I this one already has. I mean, again, this is a huge step forward from where they were even just a very short period of time ago. So a year from now, we might be talking about some huge breakthrough they've made on this. Or 6 months. We'll see.
Let's move to a lighthearted topic for a second,
Phil.
Well, it's not exactly lighthearted. Terminator.
There you go.
If the apocalypse was lighthearted, then...
More fun escapist to entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. Did you catch any of the Sarah Connor Chronicles?
I, you know what? Time zone-wise, that wasn't working out for me very well. I did catch a few minutes of it. I do have it TiVoing. Actually, it's over. It ended right... Oh, no, it's...
It's
ending
I'm
now.
Sure.
Yes.
Well, you will enjoy it. I don't want to spoil anything for you, but just to say that that show rocks, and catch it on your TiVo a little later. You know, one thing I can say without spoiling it for you is that when I first heard that they were going to make a show called Sarah Connor's Chronicles, I thought to myself, well, you know, I've seen Terminator 3. She's dead of cancer. You know,
right.
Why are we going to go back now and rehash, what happened to Sarah Connor right after Terminator 2?
Right.
That's when it's set, basically.
I did catch a few minutes of it. It looks like he's a few years older than he was in Terminator 2, but obviously not as old as in Terminator 3, and his mother's still alive. So it's
somewhere
between those two movies.
That's right. It's 1999.
So what's the big deal? So it's before she died of cancer, right?
Right. And so, you know, you're thinking to yourself, well, you know, why should I care? Well, it's the show is very clever in handling that, and you will care. And so you will like this very much. And obviously the production values can't be on par with a Terminator movie. They can't spend $100 million per episode.
Right.
But I bet you they spend several million per episode, and it's quite well. And if you happen to be a fan of Serenity, and who isn't, you will be happy with the show.
Well, you can go ahead and say why that is.
Well, the actress that portrayed River Tam is in the show.
She is a character in. In fact, we got a picture over there on the blog. She's a character in the. In the new Sarah Connor Chronicles program, and plays a teenager. I was just saying, we were talking about this before the show, it seems like she's got a good run here of being a teenager. She's been a teenager for at least the last, six, 7 years.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, my comment to that is there's worse things than...
There's certainly worse things you can have than an extended adolescent.
That's right. I was thinking of poor Angela Lansbury. I think she played, Elvis's mother when she was Elvis's age.
Yeah.
she could play someone in her advanced middle years when she was like 30.
Right, so she played an old lady for 50 years.
Yeah, she's
kind of her career.
Yeah.
One could do a lot worse. So you're going to give it a thumbs up.
Definitely a thumbs up. Oh, and it's a two. I can tell you this without ruining anything. It's a two-part pilot. It looks like you'll get to watch the next part tomorrow night. So
now, one of the things that just occurred to me as we were talking about this. Do you watch Battlestar Galactica at all?
You know, after Starbuck died, I kind of lost interest in it. She was a big deal, and they just threw that character away with such disregard. But now I'm seeing, that same actress back on the show, and so obviously I need to watch the show to figure out how that's possible. So
Starbuck did not die.
I
don't know where you're coming up with Starbuck dying. I'm trying to think of now. When
dived into the atmosphere.
Oh, right. Towards the end of the last season. Oh, you're right. She did die. But then, okay. I'm with you now.
Okay. And I don't know how it is that she's back on the show. She's a Cylon.
This is the thing. She amazingly reappeared. Spoilers all around here, ladies and gentlemen, for anyone who didn't see the end of... season 3, but yeah, she miraculously reappeared at the end of the, she did die, yes, and then miraculously reappeared at the end of the third season and declared that she's been to Earth, she knows the way, and she's getting ready to lead them all back to Earth.
Well, that's cool.
So,
okay.
But it raises all kinds of questions about
like she was off the show for good and was going to be on Bionic Woman.
Well, yeah, that doesn't look like a long-term career choice.
Bionic Woman. Is it already off the air? Because it kind of sucks.
Well, I don't know. A lot of things are on hiatus, what with the writer's strike, I think.
I guess so. I didn't like Bionic Woman all that much.
But I just couldn't get with it. She seemed too young or something. I don't know.
It just didn't work. for whatever
reason. No, Lindsey Wagner,
I guess.
Bottom line. But where I was going with that was Battlestar Galactica and Terminator have in common two major motifs. One is the robot uprising.
Right.
And the other is the mother figure with cancer.
That's true.
So these two shows have something in common. Now, how would you compare and contrast these two shows, having seen the pilot for the new Terminator series? How does it compare to Battlestar Galactica in terms of its handling of the hard takeoff, unfriendly AI singularity issues that both of these stories raise?
I think the time travel thing is what makes it such a mind-bending thing with Terminator.
Okay.
Nothing is set in stone in Terminator. You know, you see, for example, the end of the world that you see in Terminator 3, well, that's just the end of the world for that timeline, you know. As long as you've got time travel as a possibility, you can remake anything. And so anything that you see is always subject to change in the Terminator universe.
Couldn't that easily become like a crutch? It could become like an easy way out from any storyline that you paint yourself into.
Yeah, that's in the Star Trek universe, Gene Roddenberry hated time travel for that very reason. You know, it's just too easy, you know, to just use that as a crutch. And so, you know, two things he never wanted to happen: don't use time travel as a crutch,
right?
You know, and which it was. It was used that way a number of occasions. And also, don't get too funky with the transporter. You know, if you did, you know, you beam somebody down to the surface of a planet, they get killed, the red shirt dies, and then, well, you know, we got his pattern in the buffer.
Right.
We can always just reconstitute red shirt number two, and he's ready to go in the next show. And that means nothing really has any climactic, you know, nothing has any weight.
Right.
When you, if you can fix everything with time travel or a or the transporter, and so
although that would make a very disturbing Star Trek episode if they were to do that. Well, we really need that guy, so just
we'll just
whip out another one.
Yeah.
Should we tell him?
no, need bothering. But you're right. So I guess that is the case with Terminator, but you know they've never. Not in the movies, at least, not so far in the series, have they. And they're going to have the opportunity to use it as a crutch, and so let's just see. I give them the benefit of the doubt. The pilot's certainly very good. So,
well, looking forward to seeing that. Terminator is big. I don't know, kind of a long-standing franchise for those of us who follow this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've been a big fan, huge fan of the Terminator franchise. I guess I must have been, I don't know, a freshman in high school? I mean, a lot of water under the bridge.
Yeah, when did it come out? 85, 86, something
like
that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Right here, I'm approaching 40, and, you know, it's been around most of my life, longer than I've been an adult. Yeah, I've been a fan of it. So.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. That's for
sure.
I noticed a little tribute there. I believe the girl is named Cameron, is that right? Is that a little James Cameron? tribute there. I think maybe that they've thrown in there, having the love interest named after the director of the original movies. Does he?
I thought it was a nice little tribute. Well, I don't know if it's a tribute. It's just a nod to the fans of the movies that the alias that Sarah used at one point in the pilot was Sarah Reese. And, you know, Reese, of course, was our first savior in the original movie.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. There it is. Yeah. And the father of the John. No.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
John's father.
Yeah.
Was Kyle Reese.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah. Now, that's some good Terminator trivia. Right
there. Yeah, there you go. And we got somebody in the chat room says Terminator came out in 84.
84.
That sounds right.
Thank you, our astute chat room folks standing by there with their almanac in hand, huh?
That's
or,
right.
Well, actually, they can, Google.
They can Google it, or they might. Hey, we got a great audience. They probably know it.
They just know this stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Smart folks.
Any rate, but that's some fun stuff there.
Well, you'd also mentioned another keeping it on the entertainment side for a minute, I took the kids to a movie today. Is that right?
Oh yeah, went to see Water Horse.
Now, is that a sequel or is that the first one?
First one.
It seems I've been seeing previews for this thing forever. That's why.
I tell you, it was not a bad movie at all, and it got great reviews. I went like to Rotten Tomatoes to check it out. And, you know, I had kind of a funny feeling it was going to not be all that great, and went and looked at the reviews, and it's got like, you know, 85 to 90%. I forget exactly, but I mean, at a very high percentage of critics thought it was a fine movie.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was a little dull. I really did. You know, I can pretty much tell you in like 10 words what happens. You know.
Well, let me try. I'll take a stab.
Okay, take a stab at it.
Seen the trailer.
Yeah, you know, it can't be spoilers if you've never seen it. So
that's right.
You know, take a stab at it.
A kid adopts essentially the Loch Ness Monster. It's not the Loch Ness Monster, but it's some lake monster somewhere.
Okay.
And
it is the Loch Ness Monster.
Oh, it is actually the Loch Ness Monster. Okay, well,
okay.
I didn't know that from the preview.
All right.
A kid adopts the Loch Ness Monster and has to protect it from people who want to do experiments on it or something. I don't know what
and it's set in World War II.
It's set in World War II. I didn't realize that either. Okay. So does Nessie fight the Nazis?
I was hoping.
Now that would be kind of cool.
That would have been cool.
Yeah. But no.
But they didn't go there. And that's, you know, I could tell that the writer of that movie was a bit of a pacifist. And, you know, I don't have anything against pacifists, but come on, give me a little conflict. And if I'm going to spend, you know, lay out the money to come see the movie, I want to have some conflict to resolve. You know?
Right. Well, plus, if you're going to have a sea monster, I mean, you want it taken out of a U-boat, if possible. I'm just saying, you know, that would just be
that
cool
would be
to watch.
Very cool to see that happen, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You know, just kick that, you know, put that fin around there right into the side of a U-boat, and there you go. That'd been cool. But
that would have been cool. But no, so what is the major drama? It's all family drama, or?
You know how Free Willy ended?
Yes.
Free Willy, like, jumps over or something?
Yep.
Okay. You've seen this movie, then. Well, you know, I need to brag on one thing. Well, a couple of things. The period stuff looked great.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it really looked like a good period movie from World War II. The other thing is the CGI, particularly of the young, right out of the egg creature, was so good. It's the best CGI creature effects I think I've ever seen.
So this is
it looked like a real creature. It looked like a real little Nessie.
So there's more than one Nessie then?
No.
Well, but so this is saying Nessie's only been there since like World War II?
One Nessie at a time, and
there's one Nessie at a time. Okay.
And almost like a phoenix creature, you know, they die and then the next one comes along, kind of thing. But anyway, that was the deal.
But anyway, that's a lot of time for us to spend on a movie that you don't really recommend all that.
Not all that highly. If you got kids and you want something that's safe family entertainment, that certainly is. It's nothing harmful for kids in that. And my kids were entertained. I was not particularly entertained.
All right. Well, there you go.
There you go. So there, a negative review. We don't give a whole lot of negative reviews. If we don't like it, we usually don't mention it. But
yeah, or sit through it. Frankly.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, with the kids, you pretty much, you know, you're kind of, you're not going to go, oh, this is boring, we're out of here.
Yeah, we're out of here. No. My kids were riveted.
They really were.
Well,
so it hit its target audience.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's the important thing. Okay.
Exactly.
All right, well, Stephen, I think we have come to the end of our time here. Is there anything else briefly we wanted to touch on before we wrap this up?
Well, let me just real quickly hit on something.
Okay.
You know, we had Tobias Buckeye last week, and we were kind of talking about the issue of sequels and non-sequels that are part of a series and all that.
Right.
I walk into my bookstore here, and the last couple of times I walked in the bookstore, there's been a novel out there like that they're really pushing. It's right up front. You know, you walk in the door, and it's right up in your face.
Uh-huh.
The novel is World Without End.
Okay.
Okay.
And the author is?
And the author is Ken Follett.
Follett.
Is it, how do you pronounce it?
I always said Follett, but
F-O-L-L-E-T-T, Follett, or something like that. Anyway. And so I pick up the book, looks fascinating and everything, and you know, I you know, go to the flap, the inner flap, and read what the critics have to say. And, you know, like every one of the critics is saying, at long last, the follow-up to Pillars of the Earth, great, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, and just, you know, basically saying in their critique of the book that, you know, that they've been waiting for a sequel to Pillars of the Earth. Well, I go to the back, you know, it's not up in, Pillars of the Earth is not up in your face like this new one is, okay?
Right.
So I dig it out of the stack.
See, now, if they were any good at marketing, they'd have a bunch of copies of that out there, too.
They would have had that, too. And somebody, obviously, at the publisher thought the same thing because this was a brand new edition.
Mm-hmm.
That was made, obviously, to go alongside. It even had a similar design on the cover of this brand new edition as the follow-up, okay?
Right.
But the news didn't make it to Barnes & Noble's. But anyway, so I pick up Pillars of the Earth, and this thing was written in the late 1980s, you know?
Okay.
And
this is it's a science fiction story, or
no. This
Ken Follett, he does
this
spy.
Is a historical fiction. Okay,
historical
this,
fiction. Okay,
You know, set in the medieval period. One of the main characters is a guy who wants to build a cathedral. He's a master craftsman. Okay.
Okay.
The thing is just fascinating. I ended up buying it, and I guess my point is, people, you know, it was the sequel was a non-sequel, okay? And I could have taken the new book, like, you know, much as Tobias has said of his own books, I could have taken the new book and read it and not have had a poorer experience. But, you know, the reason I didn't, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, was, you know, if somebody's been waiting 20 years for a sequel, then maybe the original might be pretty good.
Well, exactly, yeah.
And this thing is absolutely great. I highly recommend it. It's Pillars of the Earth. And the thing is like a tome. It's like 1,000 pages. And the author said he was taking a big risk with that particular book because he could crank out a thriller once a year and had been doing it for years. And then he took like
sure. I think of him as writing these spy novel type.
Yeah, and he does, and
yeah.
And he can reliably crank one of those things out every year and earn great money for that. Well, this is totally different from anything he's ever written, and it took him 3 years plus, and you know, instead of working 5 days a week, he was working like 7 days a week, and the amount that went into it and the labor, he said he was just exhausted from it. And then he went back to writing thrillers for 20 years, and he finally came back and wrote a follow-up because it's still the best-selling book that he's ever written. And
interesting.
Pillars is. And so, anyway, the cast of characters in it is so well, you know, realized and everything. It reminds me, although it's kind of a different genre from Neal Stephenson's work.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of that level of, you know,
that level of detail and immersion into that world, kind of.
Exactly. And so I highly recommend Pillars of the Earth.
All right. And so you recommend starting with the first book and then moving on to the...
That's what I'm doing, and I'm glad I did.
Okay, well, I want to report... I'm almost at the end now of Time's Eye, the actual first book in the Time Odyssey series, and I'm really glad that I went back and started at the beginning. So.
Hey, somebody in the comments writes, Pillars, I guess, is a struggle between good and evil, or a struggle between good and evil erupts, turning church against state and brother against brother. Okay.
Very nice.
Somebody obviously has read it. So, great book.
Outstanding. Yeah. Okay. Well, so highly recommended. All I can say about Time's Eye is that it does in fact deliver on a battle between. Here's a spoiler coming. A battle between Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan.
Okay.
If you ever wanted to read that, this is your book, right?
Well,
all right, Stephen. Well, I think that does do it for tonight, then, unless we had something else.
We could go on and on, but I think this is a good place to stop, Phil, and we can get into more stuff next week.
Well, what's fun is we made the news our guest, and yet we didn't get very deep into, the news just has so much more, like all of our guests. There was just so much more we could have touched on, but hey, we've got as we noted earlier before the show started, I think that we may have now done as many fast forward radios on Blog Talk Radio as we had done total using all the different formats. So we got a lot of shows before us here, and we'll have plenty of time to get to these other topics.
That's great. Well, we do have some music tonight.
What do we got?
Codaphonic is the band. And the song is Sun Versus the Moon.
Sun Versus the Moon. All right. Well, we'll look forward to listening to that. And, Stephen, it was great talking with you. Look forward to talking with you again next week. Thanks
yep.
for all of you listening in. We'll see you on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
Yeah.